two propositions are stated as facts in Dr. Crawford's fascinating talk. The first is that Dr. Crawford and, one assumes, his daughter do not like wearing masks, the dislike being further explained by the sense of feeling oppressed by the local masking rules when they are not in a particular instance useful. The second, not directly stated but referred to parenthetically as if it were an established presupposition, is that mask rules, even when useless in some situations, may be generally effective. And that they do not essentially reduce the transmissibility of the COVID virus. I see no cause to doubt Dr. Crawford's first proposition, his dislike of masks and his annoyance at being there being required, an experience I share. But as for the second, Dr. Crawford gives no evidence for his assumption that masks were useless at the time. And since I'm not an epidemiologist, I could not dispute any evidence he might give if he were to give it. All the sources I might consult to verify such a proposition, Science magazine, to which I subscribe, Nature, the NIH, the CDC, the Lancet, the British Medical Journal, and so on, seem to disagree with his second proposition. Perhaps he means that the situation has changed with respect to the utility of masks because of the greater transmissibility of the Delta variant. My sources seem to agree that the Delta variant increases the infectiveness of COVID, but has not been shown to reduce the proportion of such infections that are stopped by mass masking. I find it hard to believe that all the major medical research institutions could collude in the truly massive tampering with evidence required if their conclusions that masks and masking requirements significantly reduce infection and death were fabricated at the behest of secret government operatives. It seems especially unlikely during a period in which the government was in the hands of an administration clearly skeptical about the seriousness of the pandemic. Not to speak of the degree of discipline required for all the corporate, professional, and legal oversight bodies that guard the integrity of research to conceal and silence the fraud. But in courtesy to Dr. Crawford and in recognition of my own limitations as a pandemic expert, I will consider the point open. However, I must note that if masks really do reduce deaths by the thousands or millions as is claimed, the mask mandates might very well be perfectly reasonable and no more despotic than the traffic rules that we sometimes testily obey. I am not free to drive on the left side of the road here, even if the road is totally empty, and I don't feel it as an imposition. So I must treat the lecture as hypothetical, involving not one but two hypothetical assumptions. The first, that because masks are useless in some contexts, there should be no rules about it. And second, that mask rules are not a mere result of bureaucratic clumsiness and panic, but part of a systematic program of indoctrination and social control with the purpose of instituting a despotism. My expertise, such as it is literary, cultural, and philosophical. So if I can cast any light on Dr. Crawford's offering, it must be as a theory about political argumentation and as evidence in itself of cultural trends in public opinion during a plague, historically a time of extreme psychological and social stress. Dr. Crawford's argument seems to run as follows. We have moved from a cultural state in which truth was established by pure rational argument to a time when emotional and psychological factors are allowed to play a part in persuasion, and those factors are now being used exclusively by government to establish a kind of slave state. Several problems with this analysis immediately appear. The first is that the distinction he draws is actually a very ancient one between logic and rhetoric, two parts of the old trivium. Logic, together with grammar, established the rules of rational inference. Rhetoric provided the motivation, principles, and moral force of an argument. There was never a time when logic was the only factor in argument. American history alone is full of passionate appeals, subtle innuendos, and the strategic arrangement of evidence, both for good and ill. So the use of rhetoric, emotional persuasion, is no new phenomenon. Nudging is a form of rhetoric. Do anti-maskers not use nudges of 100 kinds, social, political, economic, and so on? Dr. Crawford appears to object to rhetoric when used by our elected governmental institutions, but is very free in his own use of it. His introductory picture of the gasping daughter and the browbeaten citizen is an adroit and classical example. We are rightly nudged by it. But there is another problem with Dr. Crawford's theory. In the Renaissance, during a prolonged battle between Ramist rhetoricians and more traditional Socratic scholastics, a third factor in the establishment of truth was emerging, that is, systematic sensory observation of physical reality, extended by experimental protocols and statistical and mathematical analysis. The scientific community, with all its checks and balances, replication, journal review, competition between rival hypotheses, etc., established collectively agreed theories subject to further research. As a former scientist, Dr. Crawford is well aware of all this. But Dr. Crawford has purported to reveal a vast system of evidence tampering that must discredit any appeal to public scientific evidence. So, leaving aside his own use of it, rhetoric must be avoided as it favors only government power, and scientific evidence is now tainted by despotic interference and evidence tampering. So all we have left is logic, with no principles appealed to by rhetoric or empirical facts supplied by science. Dr. Crawford and I probably agree that the assault on the feasibility of finding truth that has been conducted in the humanities and social sciences, characterized variously as woke ideology, social construction, critical theory, and so on, is a pernicious development along a tradition that included catastrophic economic misapprehensions and real, continuing, brutal despotisms. But his apparent skepticism about masking is sadly reminiscent of woke theories that cast doubt on the science of sex and gender or on the historical reality of America's pledge of human equality, theories that, like Dr. Crawford's, also appeal to the idea of a vast conspiracy by the powers that be. The rhetorical appeal to liberate us from hidden conspiracies is a weapon that anyone can use. So, since I cannot be really useful as a respondent to Dr. Crawford's arguments, I must treat his piece as a literary text grappling with a moment of extreme social, political, and existential stress. As such, Dr. Crawford's piece is an eloquent expression of a widely shared cultural phenomenon that has a distinguished record in the great literatures of the world. Pandemic can bend or break our usual easygoing social and cultural agreement to differ. Think of the auto da fé, in which conversos were burned at the stake as plague carriers, the pogroms, inquisitions, massacres, ritual sacrifices, and political upheavals that have accompanied the plagues of the past. Paranoia is the central theme. The great Greek poets perhaps grasped it best, though the biblical plagues of Egypt, leading to the separation and expulsion of one ethnic moiety of that civilization, can also cast light on the issue. Homer begins the tragic story of the Iliad with a plague. Plague is a core theme in Sophocles' Oedipus trilogy and in the Oresteia. And for a modern reader, what stands out in the response of the Greek city, with all its rational and humane principles, is the exponential ratcheting up of paranoia to the point of monstrous tragedy. When plague strikes Thebes, Oedipus, the rational solver of the Sphinx's riddle, becomes insanely paranoid about the intentions of Creon and Tiresias. The city attributes agency and intentionality to the plague, seeking the god that caused it, the infraction that provoked it, and the human culprit or culprits that brought such a huge misfortune on the city. Following Thebes' plague and civil war, Creon in turn ends up destroying Antigone, who is herself suffused with paranoia, and all the rest of his close kin. Purification rites and sacrifices rebound upon the sacrificer. In the Iliad, Agamemnon's characteristic paranoia rises to its height when plague strikes the Greek army besieging Troy. Argos, like Thebes, falls to the same fate in Sophocles' other great Dionysian trilogy. A persistent theme in plague stories is the idea that only the sacrifice of one's kin can assuage the past crime of which the plague is the punishment, and persuade the gods to desist from their avenging fury. In today's America, the plague is not the only motive for paranoia, obviously. The banking and housing crises deprived millions of Americans of homes and jobs. The enormous expansion of social media, together with the bewildering changes in communication technology, the traffic in purloined information, cyber scams, foreign clickbait hackers, the ease of electronic forgery, the shocking loss of privacy, and the paradoxical ease of anonymity for bad actors are other generators of paranoia. And the great demographic change in which pinker-skinned people are about to be outnumbered by browner-skinned ones awakens atavistic tribal furies whose driving force is paranoia. 9/11 and the rise of global terrorism have us still have us all on edge. On the international stage, the nuclear menace has re-emerged together with the paranoia I remember from the 1960s. To me, as an immigrant from Europe of two world wars, it's amazing that America has survived as a polity at all. It nearly didn't last January. My respect for the checks and balances of the Constitution signed in Philadelphia has multiplied with every passing year. So it is not surprising that paranoia is the overwhelming theme of our current national discourse. Perhaps its only virtue is that it truly includes all shades of the political spectrum. On the left, Black Lives Matter is predicated on a vast white secret conspiracy founded in 1619 and designed to impoverish and immiserate people of color. Critical race theory implicates all pale-skinned people in an ancient and continuing crime. Woke gender studies targets the vast cisgender conspiracy to crush human identity freedom. The old left and part of the new right see all of our troubles as coming from the vast secret conspiracy of the multinational global corporations. Communism is surely perhaps the most durable and deadly of all the conspiracy and purification cults. Both the right and left have traditional anti-Semitic wings that posit the vast secret conspiracy of the Jews, always a useful and reliable scapegoat over these last 3,000 years or so. The old right continues to believe in the vast secret conspiracy of the socialists, in which the inner circles of Venezuela, Denmark, China, North Korea, California, Sweden, Zimbabwe, and the city of Portland huddle to plot strategy in some Davos of the political mind. The new right believes in an electoral conspiracy so vast that it includes not only the whole of the Democratic Party, but also the entire judicial system, most of corporate America, and a large swathe of Republican Party government representatives and civil servants, a conspiracy so menacing and effective that no whistleblower in the electoral system has dared to break the omerta. But rising above these causes of mistrust, perhaps the greatest source of paranoia and the greatest menace to human communities throughout the history of the human species has been plagues. In prehistoric times, tribes were so isolated from each other that when two of them came into contact, both would have been swept by deadly infections to which the other tribe had become immune the hard way. Much of our genetically inherited natural human racism comes from this biological history, as do our culturally universal practices of scapegoating, the attribution of destructive natural phenomena to divine intentional agency, and our obsessive rites of purification and sacrifice. Child sacrifice in many cultures may have something to do with the high effectiveness of children as disease vectors. Perhaps this archetype is at the bottom of the QAnon theories about pedophilia and the old canard about Jews sacrificing babies. Paranoia begets paranoia. In later times, the discovery and exploration of other continents has led to mass pandemic events that far outweigh in human damage any additional harms such as enslavement, cultural oppression, warfare, or economic exploitation. One of the benefits of civilization is that our medical sciences are beginning to get control of the plague mechanism and liberate our species from this most ancient and deadly of our enemies. Let's not turn on the very agents of that liberation. When plagues erupt, the balance and sanity of the human mind cannot be trusted without the strict guards on our subjectivity that can only be taught by our long traditions in the humanities. And one might add, sadly, that are more honored in their breach than in their observance, and far less taught than in the past, as Dr. Crawford would agree. We must correct our own natural tendency to blame and scapegoat when we need to patiently endure what must be endured, collect all the information we can, vigorously explore remedies, and above all, organize and cooperate with our neighbors and fellow citizens of whatever color or opinion. It seems to me that we in the Philadelphia Society, inheritors of that tradition of humane reason that Dr. Crawford rightly praises, need to err, if we must err, heavily on the side of caution in any imputation of secret malign intention in these plague times. Mr. Putin rejoices, no doubt, not only when we become obsessed with enemies that do not exist, but even when we become obsessed with enemies that do exist. Being obsessed with enemies always weakens the good warrior. Dealing with enemies in a business-like way without damaging one's own sincere dissenters and inflaming one's own true believers is the only sane path. Though in pre-industrial times, most of the tenure of the human race on this planet, paranoia was often justified and a useful rule of thumb in avoiding plagues, in modern times it is increasingly self-defeating. The issue is trust. In tribal societies, instinct reinforces your trust of your kin and your suspicion of strangers. In the market economies that make free republics possible, mutual self-interest replaces tribal trust. The great crime of the far left was to attack the institutions that allow the market to play its positive sum game, in which the gain of one partner to a contract is consistent with the gain of the other. Paranoia against the rich is an easy button to press, since it secretly promises looting opportunities. But once that paranoia is detected by the rich, right-wing paranoia, assisted by fear of economic loss, can be even crueler because more effective, thus justifying the paranoia of the left in turn. Paranoia is the emotion that, in defense of tribal solidarity, forbids any trust in the other. But the problem of paranoia is that it makes you untrustworthy to possible helpful partners. There is nothing so untrustworthy as a paranoid, an untrusting person. We humans have a very fine antennae for detecting mistrust in others. And when we do so, we become paranoid about them in turn, and thus untrustworthy ourselves. Paranoia feeds on itself. Red and blue America both regard each other as being paranoid and thus untrustworthy. The operations of this mutual reinforcement of mistrust is itself an epidemic that spreads exponentially. Let us closely examine the plausibility of our conspiracy theories, whether it be the multinational corporate complex, the great global warming hoax, the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the 1619 Project, the socialist cabal, the Islamic menace, QAnon, the faked moon landing, the faked election, the cisgender program of oppression, Opus Dei, or the administrative state. Conspiracies on the scale that the plague mentality imagines require an impossibly brilliant satanic unanimity. Will Rogers famously said, "I am not a member of any organized political party. I am a Democrat." The same could be said about almost every other political group in our argumentative republic. Lots of people think silly things, and often they get together and think them together. They can, and occasionally do, get organized enough to do something horrible, like what happened on January the 6th. And sometimes people profit from such actions. But usually they end up destroying themselves as do the great paranoids in the Greek theatre. And we do not need to become as paranoid as they are. It's significant that a thinker as original and thoughtful as Dr. Crawford would interpret the admittedly clumsy and inconsistent attempt by our tangled hierarchy of institutions to protect us from a rather horrible death as a plot to brainwash us into a totalitarian state regime. I take his eloquent essay as a lively literary evocation of the plague fatigue that we all feel and the paranoia that emerges as a result. Recognizing and bringing to the surface our own atavistic responses may itself serve a useful purpose. We need such help in correcting our inborn biases. The hardest thing we have to do, and the most important, is, as the boring cliche exists, to find common ground with our fellow Americans and fellow humans in general, and forgive as best we can their conspiracy theories about us. Thank you.